Good afternoon, everyone. Innes, thank you very much for that introduction. I'm not sure that I agree with your rankings about relative importance. I would have myself much further down the list, but I do try and be not to be controversial. I have participated in AI group events for many years, and I've always valued very much hearing from your members, so it's a real pleasure to be back here in Melbourne today. As Innes said, I've chosen as the title of my remarks today, or the title, Productivity, Wages and Prosperity. I know these three themes are important to members of the AI group, and they're also really important to the broader Australian community. I think, as Jeff said earlier, Australians enjoy a level of economic prosperity that few other people in the world enjoy. Per capita incomes here are high, and so is wealth per capita. We've also avoided bouts of high unemployment now for over a quarter of a century. Our banking system's strong. We have world-class natural resources, and Australians have access to high-quality healthcare and education. So there really is much for us to feel fortunate about. The question is, how do we sustain this prosperity? It's an important question to be asking. At the moment, there is unease in parts of the community about the future of work, about competition from overseas, and about the implications of technology. I know these are all issues that the members of the AI group are dealing with every single day. But for others in our community, these concerns are being brought into sharper focus over the last couple of years by unusually slow growth in nominal wages. As we address these important issues, we also need to keep focused on the critical task of raising national productivity, as Innes said. After all, lifting productivity is the key to building on our current prosperity and ensuring sustained growth in wages and incomes, and there are no shortage of good ideas here for us to pursue. My remarks this afternoon are going to be in four parts. First, I'll briefly cover the recent economic data. And then with that context, I'll talk about some of the reasons why wage growth has been as low as it has recently. I'll then turn to productivity growth. And finally, I'll say a few words about the recent monetary policy decisions by the Reserve Bank Board. So first to the recent economic data. And last week's national accounts contained positive news about the Australian economy. As you can see here in this first chart, GDP rose by 3.1% over the year, and that outcome was stronger than we were expecting. The non-farm economy grew at 3.6% over the year, so that's quite strong growth. This outcome is consistent with the central scenario the Reserve Bank has had for some time, that this year and next the Australian economy would grow more quickly than it has over recent years. One particularly pleasing feature of the national accounts was the ongoing rise in investment. Sarah. Non-mining business investment has increased by 10% over the past year, and you can see that on the left-hand side there. This lift is consistent with current business conditions, which, as measured by the AIG's own survey, are the highest level for many years. Investment is also being supported by increased spending on infrastructure, including in the areas of transport and renewable energy. So the investment story is a very positive one at the moment. One area that we continue to watch very carefully is consumption growth. Over the year, household consumption rose by 2.9%. That's a reasonable outcome, although growth in the March quarter was on the soft side. But over the year, stronger employment growth has contributed to a pickup in wage-related income, and this is helping support spending in the economy. At the same time, though, the level of household debt remains very high. And the housing markets in Sydney and Melbourne are both going through a period of adjustment after earlier very large price rises. And credit standards are also being tightened. So we're paying close attention to household finances at the moment. On the international front, the economic conditions remain pretty strong. The US and Japanese labour markets are quite tight, and Asia, including China, is benefiting from an upswing in trade and investment. At the same time, though, recent developments have increased some of the tail risks. One of these is political developments in Italy, which again have put the spotlight on the debt dynamics and the underlying intentions in the euro area. Another potential source of a financial shock is the increasing strains in several emerging market economies, including Argentina, Brazil and Turkey. And finally, there's the ongoing risk of an escalation in trade tensions sparked by the policies of the US administration. So against what is a reasonably positive international backdrop, these are some of the areas that we're currently watching. Excuse me. I would now like to turn to the issue that has attracted a lot of attention recently, and that is wages growth. Over recent times, wage growth in Australia around the 2% mark has become the norm. Some time back, the norm was more like 3 to 4%, and you can see the change in this chart. The downward shift in the rate of wage growth is clearly evident in the wage price index, as well as in the more volatile measure of average hourly earnings from the national accounts. And there are both cyclical and structural factors at work here. From the cyclical perspective, there is still a deal of spare capacity in our labour market. As you can see here, the unemployment rate has been around 5.5% for a year now. While we can't be definitive about what constitutes full employment, most conventional estimates for Australia are that it means an unemployment rate of around 5%. It is possible, though, that we could do better than this, especially if we approach the 5% mark at a steady pace rather than too quickly, as we're currently doing. Indeed, in a number of other countries, estimates of unemployment, of the unemployment rate associated with full employment, are being revised lower as wage increases remain subdued in an environment where we have low unemployment rates. We have an open mind as to whether this might turn out to be the case in Australia too. I certainly hope it is. Time will tell, though. Broader measures of underutilisation suggest another source of spare capacity in the labour market. Currently, around one-third of workers work part-time, with most of these people happy to work part-time for personal reasons. However, of those working part-time, around one-quarter would like more hours than they currently do, and on average, they would like to work an extra 2 days a week. If we account for this, these extra hours are equivalent to around 3% of the labour force. This suggests that the overall labour underutilisation rate is around 8.75% compared to the 5.5% traditional unemployment rate measure based on the number of unemployed people. Recent experience also reminds us of another important source of labour supply, and that's higher labour force participation, and Innes mentioned this. You can see the recent lift in labour force participation in this chart. As we've seen over recent times, when jobs are there, people stay in the workforce longer, and others who had not been looking for jobs start looking for jobs. So the supply side of our labour market is turning out to be quite flexible, even more so than we'd earlier thought. Another cyclical element that has affected average hourly earnings over recent years is the decline in very highly paid jobs in the resources sector as the mining boom came to an end. It looks, though, now that this compositional shift has worked its way through. So these various cyclical factors go some way to explaining the low wage growth over recent times. When there's spare capacity in the labour market, it's understandable that wage growth is slow. Yet alone, these cyclical factors don't fully explain what's going on. Some structural factors also appear to be at work, with perhaps the most important of these related to competition and technology, and I'll come back to this in a moment. The idea that structural factors are at work is supported by this next graph, which shows the wage price index and the responses to the NAB business survey, where firms are asked whether the availability of labour is a constraint on their current output. While there is still spare capacity in the labour market, firms are finding it more difficult to find suitable workers. Yet despite this, wage growth has not responded in the way that it once did. We see a similar pattern overseas. This next graph shows wage growth in the United States and the euro area, as well as survey-based measures of labour market tightness similar to the NAB survey that I showed for Australia. In both economies, wage growth has picked up in response to the tighter labour markets, but the response is not as large as it was in the past. We're still trying to fully understand why things in so many countries are turning out to be different to in the past and how persistent that will be. Part of the story is likely to be changes in the bargaining power of workers and an increased supply of workers as the global economy becomes increasingly integrated. But another important part of the story lies in the nature of recent technological progress. And there are a couple of aspects of this progress that I think are worth pointing out. The first is that it's heavily focused on software and information technology rather than installing new and better machines. Or in other words, it's on intangible capital rather than physical capital. The second is that the dispersion of technology and productivity between leading and laggard firms has increased, perhaps because of the uneven ability of some firms to innovate and to use the new technologies. And the OECD has done some very interesting work documenting this increasing productivity gap. Both of these aspects of technology change are affecting wage dynamics, in my view. The returns to those who can develop and best use information technology have increased very strongly. These returns, though, are often highly concentrated in just a few firms and in only certain segments of the labour market. At the same time, the firms that are not able to innovate and take advantage of new technologies as quickly are slipping behind, and they feel under pressure, understandably. As a way of remaining competitive, many of these firms are responding by having a very, very strong focus on cost control. In many cases, this translates into a focus on controlling labour costs, because this is one thing they can control. And this cost control mentality does not make for an environment where firms are willing to pay larger wage increases. I think over time, we can expect the diffusion of new technology to take place. That's what the historical record suggests. I'm optimistic that this diffusion will boost aggregate productivity growth and will lift our real wages and our incomes. Advances in information technology, in artificial intelligence and in machine learning each have the potential to reshape our economies profoundly and to lift average living standards in ways that are difficult for us to envisage today. But the adoption and the diffusion of these new technologies is a gradual process. It takes time. It can take decades. And while it's taking place, the benefits of the new technologies are accruing unevenly across our community. And in my view, this is one of the key structural factors at work. Whatever weight one chooses to place on these various cyclical and structural factors, it's clear that slow wage growth is affecting our economy. On the positive side of the ledger, it's one of the factors that has helped boost employment growth over recent times. There are other factors at work as well, though. One is the low growth in wages is contributing to low rates of inflation in Australia. Indeed, if wage growth were to continue at around its current rate for an extended period, it's unlikely that the rate of inflation will average around the midpoint of the Reserve Bank's inflation target over the period ahead. Wage growth of 2% and reasonable labour productivity growth are unlikely to make for 2.5% inflation on a sustained basis, so that's an issue for us. Another consequence is that real debt burdens are higher and stay higher for longer. Many people who borrowed expected their incomes to grow at something like the old rate rather than the new rate of around 2%. With their expectations not being realised, the real value of debt stays higher for longer, and this is affecting people's spending decisions. And beyond these purely economic effects, the slow growth in wages is diminishing our sense of shared prosperity. If this remains the case, it can make needed economic reforms more difficult. Given these various effects, some pickup in wages growth would be a welcome development. It would help deliver a rate of inflation consistent with the target. It would help with the debt situation that we face, and it would add to our sense of shared prosperity. In my judgment, a return over time to a world where wage increases started with a 3 rather than a 2 is both possible and desirable. To be clear, this is not a call for a sudden jump in wages growth from the current rates to 3 point something. Rather, it will be better if this increase takes place gradually over time as the economy continues to improve. Encouragingly, there are some signs that we're starting to move in this direction, but I think it's going to be a gradual process. Labour markets in most parts of the country have tightened over the past year. One piece of evidence in support of this was in the graph that I showed earlier. There's been a sharp increase in the share of firms reporting the availability of labour as a constraint. The only other time in the past 25 years where this share has been as high as it currently is was in the early stages of the resources boom. And these survey results are consistent with what the RBA is hearing through our liaison program that Jeff mentioned earlier. One explanation for why firms are reporting that it's hard to find workers with the necessary skills is that the very high focus on cost control over recent years has led to reduced workplace training. And I think with the labour market now tightening, we're perhaps starting to pay the price for this. On a more positive note, a number of businesses and industry associations are now starting to address the skills shortages. And some businesses also tell us that another factor that has made it difficult to hire workers recently with the necessary skills is the tightening of visa requirements. It's reasonable to expect as the labour market continues to tighten, wage growth will pick up. After all, the laws of supply and demand still work. Consistent with this, we hear reports through our liaison program of wages increasing more quickly in areas where there are capacity constraints, although these reports are still not very common. As part of our liaison program, we also ask firms about their expectations for wages growth over the next year, whether it will be lower, higher, or about the same as the past year. And the results are shown in this graph. There are now more firms expecting a pickup in wages growth and fewer firms expecting a decline compared with recent years, and I think this is good news. So it is reasonable to expect a pickup in wage growth from here. But to repeat the point, the pickup is expected to be only gradual, given both the spare capacity that still exists in our labour market and the various structural factors at work that I spoke of. So this is an appropriate segue into the issue of productivity. The best outcome is one where a pickup in wages growth is accompanied by stronger growth in labour productivity. That's because, ultimately, the basis for sustained growth in our living standards and wages is to become more productive as a nation. The recent productivity data, which I'm showing here, are difficult to interpret. Despite a positive outcome in the most recent quarter, there has been no net increase in measured labour productivity growth over the past 2 years. Over those 2 years, output growth has been subdued, but employment growth has been quite strong. In other words, measured labour productivity growth has been weak. However, if we take a slightly longer period, say since the end of 2010, labour productivity growth has been better, averaging around 1.4% per year, which I think is a reasonable estimate of the rate of productivity growth that we could expect over the medium term. The outcome over recent years has been boosted by strong productivity growth in the mining sector as new production comes on stream after the investment boom. It may be that the current lull in productivity growth is just noise in the data, and that's quite common, but it may also be a sign of something more persistent. If that turned out to be the case, it would be troubling. Again, time will tell. In trying to understand recent trends, it's also useful to examine what's been happening at the broad industry groups, goods-related industries, business services and household services, and you can see the different trends here. Employment growth has been especially strong in household services, yet measured productivity growth in this area of the economy has been quite weak. Output per hour worked in this set of industries is only 4% higher than it was in 2010. In contrast, over this period, output per hour worked is up between 13 and 16% in the other two industry groups. So it's quite a different picture. Almost 40% of the workforce currently work in household services, So the weak measured productivity growth here is weighing on outcomes for the economy as a whole. It's possible that part of the story is the difficulty of measuring output in some of these service industries. Even so, last year's Shifting the Dial report by the Productivity Commission highlighted some of the steps that we could take to boost productivity in our service industries. One of these steps is ensuring a strong focus on training, on education, and on the accumulation of human capital. As I've spoken about on previous occasions, our national comparative advantage will increasingly be built on the quality of our ideas and on our human capital. This means that a continued focus on education and research is critically important. An investment in human capital also helps with two of the other issues that I touched on earlier, the diffusion of new technologies and the emerging skill shortages. One explanation for the widening gap between the leading and the laggard firms is the difficulty of employing and developing new technologies. Successfully using these technologies requires both the right management capability and the right technical skills. Both of these can be difficult to acquire. It seems reasonable then to suggest that investment in human capital can both lift the rate of technical progress and accelerate its diffusion. It is therefore an important part of addressing the slow wage growth in many advanced economies, including Australia. And another way of encouraging the more rapid diffusion of technology is ensuring that there's strong competition in our markets and in our economy. There are many other elements of the productivity debate that are also important, and I don't plan to expand on them today, but the list, I think, is well known to you. It includes the design of the tax system, the provision and pricing of infrastructure, the way we finance innovation and new business, and our business culture around innovation, risk, and entrepreneurship. We need to keep all these issues on the radar screens of both government and of business if we are to build the prosperity, or to build on the prosperity that we're currently enjoying. I'd like to close with just a few words on monetary policy. At its meeting last week, the Reserve Bank Board held the cash rate steady at 1.5%, where it's been since August 2016. Subsequent to the board meeting, the national accounts provided confirmation that the Australian economy is moving in the right direction. If this continues to be the case, it's likely that the next move in interest rates will be up and not down. It's, however, important to remember that the environment in which interest rates are increasing is also likely to be one in which people's incomes are growing more quickly than they currently are, and this will help with the adjustment. Any increase in interest rates, however, still looks to be some time off. The board will want to have reasonable confidence that inflation is picking up to be consistent with the medium-term target and that slack in the labour market is lessening. At this stage, a sustained pickup in inflation to around the midpoint of the target range is likely to require faster growth in wages than we're currently experiencing. There are reasonable grounds to expect that this increase in wage growth will occur, but for the reasons I've spoken about today, this increase is likely to be only gradual. Given this, there is not a strong case for a near-term adjustment in monetary policy. With things moving in the right direction, the board's view is that by holding rates steady, we can help promote a sense of stability and confidence in Australia. We hope that this helps Australians make the decisions that help build the future prosperity of the country that we're all so lucky to live in. Thank you very much for listening, and I'd be happy to answer some questions.
Thank you, Governor. We have a microphone roving around the room that Sarah has. We'll have time for about four or so questions. So we've got a media question as well. We'll do that as well. We'll start with some member questions. Can you just advise who you are and where you're from? And don't ask the when a rate's going up question.
Thank you.
Not for some time, I think would be my answer.
Max Newnham from Taxbiz. It's a two-barreled one from two of my passions. The first is SMSFs. They've been pilloried about supposedly they've had a major contributor to the property boom, and I'm wondering whether the Reserve's Bank done any modelling on the increased borrowing capacity of self-managed super funds behind that. And the second part of the question is a lot more general. Is the Reserve Bank worried about some of the tightening credit that I can see is happening with small businesses as a result of the Banking Royal Commission and what that will do to the overall economy?
On self-managed super funds, we haven't done any modelling, but our view has been that the self-managed super funds should not be able to borrow for property. That's our view. We haven't done any extra modelling. On tightening of credit conditions, are we worried about it? We're certainly noting that it's taking place. I think there's also a reduced demand for credit, particularly in residential area, because prices are no longer rising, so people aren't trying to borrow to buy an asset whose price is rising. Turnover's down, there's less foreign demand, and so there's less demand for credit as well, and at the same time there's some tightening on the supply side. So we're just watching it carefully. I think at the moment it's manageable. We shouldn't be too worried if credit growth slows down a bit. We've had many, many years in which credit growth was far in excess of our income growth, and the debt-to-income ratio was rising all the time. It's probably in our longer-term interest for that ratio not to continue rising, and that means that there'll be periods where credit growth is a bit slower than income growth, and we may be heading for one of those at the moment, and I don't see it particularly problematic.
Andrew North from Major Furness. Does the RBA include compulsory superannuation increases in wage growth data calculations? And if not, why not?
Well, we don't do the calculations. We rely on data provided by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And I don't think it changes the basic... If you would include the super contributions, I don't think it changes the basic story. But which is the current rate of wage growth isn't consistent with 2.5% inflation. That's kind of from the central bank's perspective. My board is supposed to deliver you an average rate of inflation of 2.5% over time, and I think there are good reasons why the government has asked us to do that. Low and stable, predictable inflation is in all our interests, and something around 2.5% is what we're shooting for. We've done that for many decades, and it's worked out very well. One of my concerns is that I'll have trouble delivering that for you if wage growth is only 2%. And if you include super, it doesn't make any difference to that basic story. So that's from my perspective at the central bank. But as an Australian, I worry more broadly about the consequences of just low nominal wage growth year after year, and the fact that many of the people who are lucky enough to live in our great country don't feel like they're sharing in the prosperity that many of us actually do enjoy. I think that's problematic. So from the central bank's point of view, it's a problem. I think from the society's point of view, it's a problem as well. And this is why I said a return to a world where wage increases start with a 3 rather than a 2, I think, is in our national interest. It's certainly in my interest as delivering you 2.5% inflation as well.
Can I just ask you a question, which is why... Is productivity, you know, you alluded to it, but why is productivity growth so low? What can we do to improve that? And do you think you alluded to it as well, but the productivity wage growth trade-off, how do we get that working in sync again?
Well, why is it so low? I'm not sure it's so low. You can look at that graph that I had up before and say, well, it's actually been okay over the last 6 years, 6 or 8 years. In the last couple of years, it's been weak. Those data are quite noisy, so I don't think you can yet draw the conclusion that labour productivity growth is unusually weak. What can we do? There is no silver bullet here that can fix it. What we've got to do is have a laser-like focus on making Australia an attractive place to invest and employ people. And how do you do that? Well, it's the tax system. It's the way we design and price the infrastructure. It's the accumulation of human capital and training. It's making sure that our markets are competitive, because there's nothing spurs business to kind of drive for productivity improvements like their competitors doing it. So they're the things we've got to work on, and there's no single policy in any of those areas, but I think there are things right across the spectrum that we can be doing. And we need, both business and government, need to be focusing very squarely on how to make Australia an attractive place to invest and employ people and to innovate. How do you do that? I don't know.
Ben Potter from the Finn.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Governor. But could you spoke quite a bit about tax policy and productivity, and I just wonder if the personal income tax cut plan outlined by the government in the budget, which there's been a bit of debate about, is going to deliver the kind of consumer response that you're looking for? Is it the best way to achieve that? And also, given that there's been some criticism that you get a windfall revenue about once a decade, if you're lucky, and we're having ours now after a decade or so. Is this the best way, and I think it's costs about $140 billion over a period of years, is this the best way to invest that revenue windfall to get the sort of productivity, the tax reform that will deliver the productivity boost that you're looking for and enable people to increase their wages? Thank you.
Well, the tax cuts will certainly help with household budgets, and that will provide a small positive stimulus to household spending, which in the current environment is useful. I'm not sure that it constitutes the fundamental type of tax reform that would make a first-order difference to the rate of productivity growth in the economy. It will help with household budgets, and I think that's what it's designed to do. It will also help with some of the work leisure choices that people make, to kind of a bit more incentive to work, because there'll be a higher return after tax return from working extra hours. So from that perspective, it's positive. But I think if you were starting from first principles and saying, well, what type of tax system do we have to make it very attractive to invest, employ people, and to innovate, you probably wouldn't design the system we currently have. And so it's a matter of kind of pushing it in the right direction over time, because the society doesn't have the appetite, I don't think, for kind of a whole-scale, rewriting of the tax code. So it's kind of an incremental process of moving it, and this is one step in that process, but it's just one step.
Right up the back on the left.
Hi. Just on this point about wage growth and shared prosperity, do you think a lack of wage growth, is it contributing to a perception of inequality, or do you think that's the actual effect that we're seeing?
I don't think the underlying issue for most of the communities kind of inequality is getting worse. It's the fact that their incomes are not rising at the rate they used to. People's incomes used to rise at 3.5% or 4% a year, and most people could look forward to that year after year, and they made their spending and, more importantly, their borrowing plans on the basis of that. And when they're only increasing at 2% a year, the debt burden that they took on when they thought their income was going to grow at 4% is more difficult to deal with, and so a lot of people are unhappy about that. And the aspirations they had for the kind of the growth in their incomes and their lifestyles aren't being met, and they're unhappy about that. It has both a nominal and real component, because nominal income growth is low, but real income growth is low as well. For 4 or 5 years, real hourly earnings have not increased. The 25 years before that, we had a fantastic period where every year real hourly earnings were rising 1.5, 2, sometimes even faster than that. And people got used to that, and it's not surprising when that's not happening anymore, we're all a bit unhappy. And I think many, many workers see the economy doing quite well, see business profits very high, and they're wondering, where's their share in that? And ultimately, that's problematic for the society. It makes it more difficult to prosecute reform in Canberra and the state capitals. And that's why I think it's in our collective interest as a country to get back to a world where people feel like they're sharing in the prosperity. It's in our long-run interest for that to take place.
Last question down here.
Yes.
Hi, Simon Roy from Amcor. What you described with regard to productivity and the slowing of wages growth coinciding with a significant increase in asset prices, homes, and debt burden seems reminiscent of what happened prior to the housing crisis in the United States, 2007-2008. Maybe Australia is a little bit less extreme than the United States, but have you guys modelled what would happen if the housing market was to correct a bit more heavily and wages growth was not to continue to be in a slow growth in Australia? What would be the kind of impact on the economy?
Well, I would take issue with your presumption that this is very much like what happened in the US. The really big difference and the very important difference is that lending standards have been tightened a lot in Australia in the last 4 or 5 years. So there has not been large-scale extension of credit to people who should not have got the loans, which is what happened in the US, and I think that's the underlying source of their problems. Very high leverage in complicated financial institutions on the back of making a lot of loans to people who shouldn't have got them. So that's very different to the situation that we face in Australia. With a bank system that's strong, it's resilient, and the credit standards have been strengthened. So I don't think that's kind of a fair comparison. What happens when housing prices decline? As long as it's not a very large decline, I think this is manageable. And we've had plenty of periods in the last 2 decades where housing prices in particularly Sydney and Melbourne have declined 10-12%. So that's what happens in the housing market. You have these big run-ups, prices stabilise, sometimes they might fall, stabilise, and then they'll rise again. And I think we're going through one of those events at the moment, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. There's been a lot of additional supply come onto the market. The rate at which we're adding to the housing stock is the fastest in quite a few decades. So that extra supply at very high prices will bring prices back, and that's what the market predicts it happen, and that's what's actually happening. So I think this is manageable. Remember, it wasn't that far long ago that people were worrying about housing affordability. That was the number one political issue 2 years ago. House prices were rising too quickly. So we shouldn't fret just because house prices aren't rising at the rate they used to. And even if they come down, I think kind of for a period before kind of the next rise, that's okay. House prices in Sydney and Melbourne are still 40% up where they were at the beginning of 2014. So there's a lot of media coverage when house prices go down, but I think you've got to have a longer-term perspective here. And the thing that gives me some comfort is the fact that the lending standards have been strengthened a lot over recent years, and we haven't had the problems that the US has had.
One last one. I missed him all the way through, so I feel guilty.
Thank you, Governor Patrick Hatch at The Age. You made a comment about business being split into leaders and laggards. Could you expand on that a little bit? Is it a cause of concern? And if so, what can be done to avoid that?
Well, I don't know whether it's a cause of concern. It is a thing that's happened. The OECD has documented this very clearly, that the productivity gaps between the leading firms in many industries and the average firm in those industries is unusually large. Kind of, if you go back over decades, the productivity gaps are large. And the thesis which I find attractive is that the leading firms have worked out how to use the new technologies. There are big economies of scale. They've been able to get market share. And they're producing fantastic services at low price. And there are many other firms that are struggling to do that. And when they're struggling to do it, what do? Well, they try and use the new technologies, but the thing they can do is to control their costs. Because if you can't compete on the basis of having the very best technology, you've got to compete on costs. And I think this is affecting the wage dynamics in many countries, that many firms feel like they have to compete. And how do you do it? You control your costs. And it's an interesting question we were talking about at our table before, is why is it that in so many labour markets now, firms are saying it's really hard to get workers. In Australia it's true, in the US it's true, in the Euro it's true. But they're not paying higher wages. They're not in the way that they used to. Why is that? And often when I ask business people, why aren't they paying higher wages, they look at me as if I'm completely mad. So why would we do that? You've got to understand it's a very competitive environment out there. It's very hard, and there are a lot of reasons. And I think it's linked in an underlying sense to technology and the struggles that many firms are having in identifying how to take advantage of new technologies. In time, we will, and we'll look back and we'll think this wave of technological progress that we're currently going through was a great enabler of higher living standards. But in the interim, it's making kind of some people feel like they're losing out, and the gains are unevenly distributed. And so I think it's a political concern, because if people feel like they're not participating in the gains here and they're struggling, they get angry, and that makes policy reform more difficult.
So we're going through a rough patch, but in good times. Could everyone please thank the Governor of the Reserve Bank, Philip Lowe.